This week on Retronauts, Capcom has left the building. Welcome to an episode of Retronauts, all about fighting games, but not just any fighting games. Specifically, we're looking at the doldrum period in the 2000s when the genre was no longer popular and finding people to actually play these games with was a much higher hurdle than it used to be. I know the enthusiast scene suffered, the competitive scene around it, around fighting games suffered for a variety of reasons that this crew will be delving into. And speaking of that crew, I've assembled an elite team, a crack squad, to talk about this era from different angles, different points of view. Hopefully by the end of this, you will have a better understanding of how we went from, you know, this arcade culture of the 90s to, you know, sort of the modern day setting of online tournaments, esports, what have you. So let's introduce everybody. We'll start with the folks furthest away from me and work our way in. So that would be our correspondent from Osaka.
Leaping in like a striker, this is Diamond Fight. Hello, everybody.
And who do we have in the Midwest?
Oh, I guess that surviving anything, even nukes, I am Ted Bob 84.
All right, and who do we have right here in the beautiful state of Maryland?
Hi, my name is Jason, but mostly everyone knows me as Rugleby.
All right, thank you. So yeah, this is a good squad for this, because we have folks who've played these games more casually at the time, to all the way to folks who were competing in tournaments and in brackets. So I think this should be a lot of fun. So yeah, this is sort of the dark age of fighting games, as it gets called. And if you're wondering why it has that name, well, that's a very good question. This was sort of a period from around 2001, 2002 until around, what would you say, about 08, 09?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, 08 is the arcade release of Street Fighter IV. And that's kind of the first light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. So,
yeah. And this was a period where, according to John Choi, who played a lot of fighting games at this point in time, he called it a time frame when old players were dropping out of active play, which is something that just happens. There's always folks leaving, but there's always folks, at least in times are good, coming in to replace them. You're getting new blood. And at this point in time, there was no real new blood coming in. Correct. I can say this personally, because this is when I was playing competitively way back when.
The other kids were finding the new hit.
That's true. You had people playing like Smash Brothers at this point. You had folks playing Halo. I know that a lot of our competitive folks moved on to that. But yeah, fighting games, good luck. We were having a real hard time finding new folks to come in. And there are a few different reasons for this, and the big one, especially in the West, especially the U.S., but also Canada, I know this was an issue in Europe as well, is that arcades were just finally on their way out. They were sailing the last ships to the West, and it was a hard time to find people to play with, let alone places to play, because these Japanese fighting game developers, the big ones, Capcom and SNK, they were each going through separate issues. The short version is neither of them were still making games quite to the same extent that they had been. Capcom realized that, hey, we're making a lot more money in the console space, so maybe we should prioritize that because we're not making a whole lot off of these fighting games anymore. So they sort of redirected all of their fighting game development teams to that, which is where we got stuff like Monster Hunter, and I believe Steel Battalion came out of some former fighting game devs. So they had that happening.
Yeah, I forget who the quote comes from. It might have been someone on the Mortal Kombat team, or maybe this is a Capcom story. But I remember around this time they were, you know, a big publisher was looking at their internal numbers, like, okay, so an arcade hit does this, and, you know, sells whatever 50,000 units, like a huge arcade game's like 50,000 units, whatever, makes this much money. And then, like, the console's like, oh, this game was a hit, and it made, like, you know, $50 million. It's like, oh, so why do we have an arcade unit anymore? Like, it dawned on people. It's like, this is what these were the numbers are pointing at. There still were, you know, arcades were still in various places, and there were still arcade games that could impact the culture as a whole, but it became much, much harder to do so. And even then, even a big arcade game just couldn't compare to the fact that everyone was having, you know, everyone had consoles at this point. You know, this is, you know, we're talking about the early 2000s. This is the era of the PS2, which to this day remains the most popular console of all time. So, yeah, it's just a sheer matter of eyeballs. It's an eyeball issue, you know? I mean, it's a pocket issue as well. But the fact that what was once the gathering point for many, many people became, no, we're playing the games at home now, and we spend a lot of money on each game, and we bring them home, and we play them for many, many hours at a time. So that's where that's one part of the shift, is that, well, if arcades are not going to be here anymore, then we got to really focus on getting people to the living room.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, but home hardware had really sort of caught up to what arcade units were able to do. You started seeing this with the Saturn and PlayStation to a certain extent, but by the time the Dreamcast and the PS2 had come along, it was really hard to justify, going into an arcade and spending your money to play a game that's going to be over in a couple of minutes when you can just play these games at home in a lot of cases. Or play stuff that looks just as good at home. So that was a big problem for arcade developers. I know Capcom moved a lot of their fighting game development over to Naomi in this sort of early aughts, because the Naomi was billed as a, well, look, this is very similar to the Dreamcast, so you can do an arcade port and have a console version without doing a lot of work. Like, it'll just take you a few extra months and you can do both. So that was sort of what saved Capcom and their fighting game division for a little bit. This all comes from the Like a Hurricane book. It's an oral history with a bunch of folks who were involved with Street Fighter and other Capcom fighting games in the 2000s and 90s. So, yeah, this was where Capcom was at. This was really their exit from the fighting game world for almost a decade, this whole time period.
Yeah, and also, with the tech there, also, the turnaround was very fast. I think some of the games that we remember most from this time, like, say, Marvel Capcom 2, I believe within a month of debuting in arcades, I think they had the Dreamcast version on store shelves, at least in Japan. So they were... You know, it wasn't like this, the old Street Fighter days where something would come out and it would be in arcades for, you know, maybe 10 months or even an entire year. And then a home port, a compromised home port at that, would suddenly show up. You know, no. It's like, we made this game. It's out in arcades. And, oh, look, it's also, you can also buy it and bring it home. Which, you know, obviously for me, it was good because, like, it means I don't have to go and find the few arcades that were left. I could just, you know, I go to Chinatown and buy my copy and just bring it home and play it on my modded Dreamcast. That's good enough for me. But, you know, for the arcades that actually wanted people to come into the arcades and play the game, not so great for them. Say, like, the Chinatown Fair arcade, although that hung in there for quite a while after. I believe Chinatown Fair didn't close until 2011. So that, you know, they were around, but yeah, eventually. Even they had to call it quits.
You're talking about CTF in United States, New York?
Yeah, on Pell? Mott? Pell?
Yeah, they around 2013, they really, really shut down as far as, like, their arcade games. Now they're just, like, you know, shooters and, you know, that kind of stuff. Henry Sen was trying to buy out that particular location, but the original owners wanted too much. She was the arcade manager at one point. And then they just wanted too much, so that's when he created Next Level.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I know back in the Detroit area, this was sort of the time frame that a lot of the competitive arcades and even the like the local area arcades started closing up. I remember we used to go, Ted, Bob, and I, because we were in the same area, and he used to play games with me. We used to go to the Tilts and Tumbles. That was at the Southland Mall.
That was one.
That was one of them. That it wasn't a great arcade, but it was a close arcade, and they had
it had the two big ones.
Yeah, they had Marvel we'll 2, and they had a Capcom versus SNK 1, and a KOF 97 machine. And they had CVS 2 for a month, and then the manager of it, Rich, decided that, no, we can just swap that out for CVS 1. That's the game everyone wants to play now that 2 is out.
It went from a machine that everybody was on every time you went there. Like, you had to, you know, put the quarter up and wait your turn, and there'd be like 5 quarters up there at least, to a machine that nobody played.
Yeah, no one was touching CVS 1.
Not because it's bad, it's just CVS 2 is the hot thing. Why CVS... do we want to play the first one?
Yeah, it was out. CVS 2 was out. That was the big game, which we'll probably touch on a little bit here. I remember there was the Time Zone that had like a Third Strike scene because they had a Third Strike machine. And there was Roscoe's in Detroit. I never got to go there, but apparently that was where all the Tekken heads went. And there was the Butterfly, which was
I forgot about that one.
Oh, yeah, the Butterfly. They hung in there for a long time. I don't think they closed until 2010 or so.
It might have been a little sooner than that, but I remember hearing about them. And I think I went there like once or twice, but I think maybe like 2008, and like someone brought it up. It's like, they're still around?
Yeah, it was a shock. And then there was Wizards, and that was the big fighting game arcade for my tenure. They got all the big stuff.
There is also Pinball Pete's in Ann Arbor.
There's Pinball Pete's in Ann Arbor. That was the core of the Ann Arbor scene, and it's still there. I don't know that anyone still plays fighting games there, but it's there. And as of this recording, the city is hearing a proposal by a developer to tear it down and replace it with a parking lot. So that's fun.
Because, of course.
That's what you always want to hear from an arcade that's apparently doing well for itself.
it's sad, too, because I went in there recently, and it's funny because they have like a whole like almost like a fighting game division in there now. It's like you got Street Fighter, you got Marvel, you got Third Strike, like all these fighting games that like they didn't have for the longest time, only up until a few years ago. But the one downside is they got rid of their big one, CVS2. That brought a tear to my eye.
I think they had the net dim on the CVS2 broke down or something, and those are really hard to replace. That's probably what happened. I know there was the American Fun Center. I don't think that's still around, but
it's not
one of the areas. What's that?
It's not. Last time I was there was like late 2010s, and like when I started going there, like kind of early 2010s, they had Tekken, they had Street Fighter, they had like a multi-MAME machine that had like everything on it, and I ran that stuff from time to time. But and like this is just like a little, almost like a really tiny hole in the wall kind of place, so not a lot of traffic in there.
Yeah, it was.
They had good stuff though, but last time I was in there, almost all that was gone, and it's just ticket stuff now.
Yeah, they were sort of the last one standing for the Detroit scene as far as like competitive fighting games went, because they had Street Fighter 4 arcade before the console port came out, and they had Tekken 6 before a console port came out. So that's where everybody went to go play those games before they could just play them at home. And yeah, Wizards, that was a big loss. They were one of the oldest arcades in the area. I think they opened in 72, and they were sort of the hot place for Mortal Kombat, Neo Geo fighting games, Street Fighter, and once Roscoe's closed, that's where all the Tekken folks went.
That is the real heart of Detroit, Wizards Arcade.
Yep.
I don't care what anybody says.
In Warren, Michigan. But it was on the other side of 8 Mile. It's close enough that everyone just called it Detroit. But yeah, they closed in 2004, and so yeah, arcades were just dying out in this time period. It was hard to find places to play, and for a genre like fighting games where the meat of it is that you're playing other people, having console home versions, like, no matter how good they are, that doesn't necessarily work out unless you already know people that you can play with. Which leads to the next problem is that Japan still had fighting game developers. They had some new ones that were sort of filling in the niche, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, and with Capcom bowing out and SNK having problems, which we haven't even touched on SNK's issues, but the new companies that were coming in, they were prioritizing arcade versions over home ports, because game centers in Japan, they were still bumping, they were still active. It wasn't until, I'd say, like, COVID that they really started having closures on the scale of the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I think I suppose it's perhaps inevitable that arcades would eventually end, just because of the fact that, you know, because consoles have long caught up, and I guess these days, you know, economy-wise, are probably stronger. Like, you buy one console and it's good for many, many long time, whereas arcade cabinets don't last. So I guess Japanese arcades were always going to go away eventually, or transform into something different. But yeah, in the early 2000s, I first came here in 2001. And yeah, when I came here, I was like, oh my God, they're everywhere. Like, I was like blown away by how many places they were in. And, you know, then I moved here in 2007, and I've been here, and I've seen the slow, gradual decline, you know, little places just completely shut down, or big places, you know, revamp, transform, you know, appeal to a more broader crowd. You know, most arcades now are basically just crane games and print club machines, and then maybe, you know, some metal games in the background. And, you know, if you're really, really lucky, there's some, you know, some classic cabinets, you know, maybe on an upper floor somewhere. But more often than not, you have to go somewhere and find a small place that's, you know, dedicated to celebrating the older games and maintaining those old cabinets and doing that thing. But yeah, in the early 2000s, I would say probably, yeah, a lot of these smaller teams or upstarts, or I guess maybe smaller teams inside larger companies, they were making these interesting fighting games, and they were making them for the arcades, and they would come out in the arcades here in Japan. And then it's like, okay, so what about overseas? Maybe.
Yeah, that was a time, because, you know, they you would get console ports for a lot of these eventually. Not all of them, but eventually a lot of them had console ports, but they would either be Japan exclusive, which means you had to have a modded PS2. They'd be very delayed. A lot of these ports came out about a year or so after the arcade version, because, you know, you had to give the operators time to make their money back. Or both would be the case. I know SNK in particular was very bad about, okay, here's our new fighting game in the arcades. We'll see the U.S. home version in about 2 years. Have fun. Hope you have a Japanese PS2.
I can't remember how long I waited. It was maybe the KOF 2001-2002 collection. I swear I kept hearing, like, it's going to be out real soon, real soon, real soon, became, like, yeah, like a year or year and a half later.
Yeah, I mean, the SNK thing is a very large topic that probably warrants its own video, but I guess the short version is SNK died, but then they got better. Like, that's the short version. The SNK, as we know it, basically went bankrupt, went out of business, and a new company came in and bought the rights, but the people who used to work at SNK sort of made their own company, and they were involved in getting back the properties they used to own, and there were some name changes in there, and the very short version is that, you know, eventually we have an SNK today with some people who were there back in the day, but mostly it's just like a new company that has the rights to the old company. But yeah, this is the period where the Neo Geo officially dies. The 2004 is the last cartridge they ever make. They had one more game in the pipes, but they wouldn't get that out until the recent Samurai Shodown collection, where they found the old ROM and they got it and even localized it, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, SNK, like, or the new SNK, I guess it was SNK Playmore or the Aruz or Eolith. I again, there's so many names involved. They after the Neo Geo hardware died, they kept making new games, but these were, I guess, mostly a Thomas Wave, right? Like, Battle Coliseum was a Thomas Wave, I believe?
Yeah, they started out on Neo Geo, I think, because after the bankruptcy and everything, they just didn't have great financial resources.
Right.
That's the story I remember hearing. So, you know, they made Neo Geo games for a few more years. They even put out a few on bespoke boards and not on cartridge. Like, there was no MVS official version for KOF 2003 or SVC Chaos. Those came out on their own boards. So they did this for a few years, and then they announced they were moving to a Thomas Wave, and they put out, I think, like 5 or 6 games on there. And then they decided to drop a Thomas Wave for Taito X2. The Type X2 board, which I think they stuck with until the Nessica came along and sort of ate everybody's lunch. So, yeah, they bounced around to a few different platforms. SNK, they had a lot of trouble sort of having success out of the arcade in the late 90s, and that sort of snowballed in the 2000s. So, like, they were putting out these arcade games, and they were pretty much at this point only putting out arcade games for their biggest franchises. So, like, you had Metal Slug, you had King of Fighters, and you had Samurai Showdown, and everything else could go to hell. sorry, everybody who really liked, Fatal Fury. It's going to take 24 years to get another one, apparently. Although they did put out Twinkle Star Sprites 2 in this period for some reason. I'm glad they did. It's a great game, but... and on top of all that, Sega pulled the plug on the Dreamcast in 2001, which means you no longer had this ready market for Naomi conversions on top of everything else that was going on. And part of that problem is that the Dreamcast was super easy to bootleg for, so, like, okay, well, now, if a new fighting game comes along, you can't just burn a disc or, like, get a boot disc together to boot up your game. You have to mod your console, because that's how it worked for the PS2. You know, you had to get the flip top or the weird little thing you jammed into the disc tray, or you had to get a Japanese PS2. So it's a pain in the ass, let me tell you.
They made you work for the love of those games.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to go on record that I did say I modded my Dreamcast. I promise I never played any pirated software. I just modded it so I could play the because, you know, all the games I wanted were in Japan. So I was buying import copies. But I promise you, if anyone Sega's listening, I did not pirate any Dreamcast software. I promise.
I never pirated, I can't say that. I did pirate one game for the Dreamcast, and that was CVS2. I did eventually buy a legitimate copy, so it's okay.
Wasn't Capcom Fighting Jam, wasn't that 06, 07?
That was like 04, I think?
04, because it didn't have an arcade release.
I think there was an arcade version of it. I think no one cared, but I think it was there.
Yeah, that one I'm not actually sure on.
Yeah, I know they had that. What was the other game? What was the other game? They had the it was a Capcom game.
The canceled All-Stars?
They had the, the dinosaurs. They had Karas. You know, he had the one-frame low shorts.
Tatsunoko
versus Capcom.
That came out, what, 05?
That was like 08, I think.
08, yeah. Those were the last two ones that came out that I remember. To my knowledge, didn't have an arcade release.
Tatsunoko was definitely an arcade release here in Japan, because I played it in the arcades here. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it came home like on the Wii or the Wii U.
Which yeah, the Wii.
Yeah. Capcom Fighting Jam, aka Capcom Evolution, that was actually the fall of 2004. So,
wow.
I don't know. Do we want to get into that game right now or talk about it later? But
you know what? Now's as good a time as any. We gotta rip off the Band-Aid. This was Capcom's... swan song for a time period.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, can I use the word abomination? Is that fair? Is that too harsh? It is.
I think it's too nice.
I just feel like, I was there. We're recording this just within minutes of me recording an episode about 2004. So I'm very much in this mind space. Like I was away at college and I heard the news, new Capcom fighting game. Oh yes. And I was there. I picked it up as soon as I could get my hands on it. And I brought it back to my dorm room and I'm like, okay, here it is. It's on my PS2. That's fine. I brought my PS2 to college. And I was like, this is what they put together. And it's just sort of this really strange looking sort of grab bag of fighters from different games, all using their own sprites, which means nothing really looks like it should belong in the same universe as anything else. You know, the poor Morrigan sprite, the poor Darkstalkers Morrigan sprite, you know, literally in its 10th year in this universe, you know, smeared with Vaseline to try and, you know, look, you know, like a human being compared to the other characters. But you also have like the Warzard, the Red Earth, like dinosaur people, and you've got the Third Strike characters, and you've got Street Fighter 2 characters. You've got some, you know, other Darkstalkers, and I mean, what is it? Ingrid is the one like original character, like yep. One original character, Ingrid, I think.
Yeah.
And they're all here. They've all these sort of very plain looking backgrounds, which I believe fans have gone through and they've looked like. A lot of the background art is just literally repurposed, like, promotional art. Like, they just scanned it in and just, like, threw it back there. Like,
yeah, like, character illustrations from, like, instruction books or covers, oh, no. Things like
right,
that.
Right, right. Like, this whole thing, you know, I know it's taboo. We don't want to call people, we don't want to say, you know, developers are lazy. We all know that, you know, it's all about, like, budgets and time. But, like, to me, as a person, you know, sitting there holding my copy, I'm like, who did this to me? What did I do to them? To deserve this, because this is terrible.
I think that was Ono's first game, right?
Yeah, his first Street Fighter type of game.
Man, so the idea, had they did it right, would have been amazing. The game was absolutely horrible. It was trash. For competitive players, we would see each other every tournament. We was like, oh yeah, it's going to be a new game coming out. You know, about time we got something else different to play. And we finally get. We're like, yeah, we're going to keep playing the games we're playing.
there was this running joke for a while that Capcom versus SNK2, like just how all the sprites like looked kind of all over the place. The joke with that was that game looked like Mugen.
Mm-hmm.
Capcom Fighting Jam was Mugen. That felt like playing an old Mugen. Like someone just took a bunch of downloaded assets, threw them together. Here you go. $60, please.
It had such a fascinating development. Cycle between, because it's not just like a fill-in for a game that didn't come out. That game was a fill-in for a game that didn't come out on top of that. So this is like two games removed from what Capcom had initially set out to do, because they were planning to do Capcom versus SNK3, which was going to use like 3D models and everything, like the Street Fighter EX games. But after SNK's bankruptcy, that was canceled because, as Capcom figured, you know, why are we doing a crossover for a company that no longer exists?
Right.
So that those assets were being reused to make Capcom Fighting All-Stars, which was going to be sort of a Capcom versus Capcom fighting game. And it had a great lineup of characters, like Hagar was there, Strider was there. They had like Street Fighter characters. I think Poison was going to be in this, going to be like one of her.
I think that was going to be her debut fighting appearance.
Unless you want to count Final Fight Revenge, which no. I wouldn't if I had any druthers. But, you know, that game went on location test. The feedback was not glowing, so Capcom, you know, killed it and had the people who were working on it work on some other game. I think it was Devil May Cry. And then, like, 6 months or so later, some Capcom management was like, hey, let's make a new fighting game. We're going to give you even less of a budget than we spent on Capcom Fighting All-Stars. So go nuts. So this had zero money. I'm honestly shocked they got a custom sprite out for Ingrid, who was supposed to be from Fighting All-Stars. Yeah. It's a bad game. I remember one of my buddies from the local scene, he was so excited about that game. He went out, got it day one. Brought it directly to our friend's house session, because he did house sessions every Friday for anyone who wanted to come through and play fighting games. usually ended up being King of Fighters and eventually the Naruto GameCube games. But we played Fighting Jam for about 20 minutes, and then he sold it for a significant discount to someone else there, because he was like, this is trash. I cannot play this.
Yeah, we played it, our Ski Sonic, who is well known, he actually got a Japanese copy. And some lore about that is here in Maryland, there's a store called Power Gamer, or was, that we would be able to get games super early, you know, Japanese release games and all that, and so forth. So he got the game early, about a couple weeks early, you know, more so. And, you know, we came to a normal CVS 2 session, like, hey, we got the new blah, blah, blah. Okay, cool. Let's see what it is. And we went to training mode, and we were just looking at it. We was like, yeah, this game sucks. Like, this is horrible. Like, how much did you pay for this? You know, and back then, paying for a Japanese game, you know, in the United States, you pay a considerable amount more. So he paid about $95. I was like, yeah, you got to get rid of that. And he definitely did. He definitely sold it a little bit less, but he definitely got most of his money back. Someone who didn't know, who more so wanted to collect, you know, their collectors. Like, oh, yeah, let me get this. And I'm pretty sure it's probably worth something now, probably next so many years. But it was horrible back then. It was terrible.
Oh, is it worth something now? I still have my copy.
I don't know. I got the Xbox version for like $15 from Pandora's Cube before it closed.
This game, it's unfortunate because it reminds me of another game that's like, you look at this on paper and this sounds awesome. And it should have been awesome, but it just didn't happen. And, you know, the other game I'm referring to is SNK vs. Capcom Chaos, which I was hyped as crazy for that roster.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure, we might get into that.
The roster was good. I'll say the roster was good. The game itself. So number one is called Zero versus Capcom Chaos. That's really, you know, what the game was. If you play Zero, the game is fun. It's amazing. If you don't play Zero, the game is not very fun. Fighting against Zero yourself, though.
This was the first time Zero was overpowered in a fighting game, and it was not the last, because that has continued in every other appearance he's ever made.
The curse continues.
Yeah, SVC Chaos, this was a 2003 release. I remember, you know, the CVS2 crew, a lot of folks had dropped off after Midwest Championships in 2000s, which was around 2002. That was like June. And we were all just waiting for the next big fighting game, because, again, that was the usual process. How did we know that there wasn't going to be a next big fighting game? So SNK announces their crossover. Everyone's hyped up. All the CVS players, they're stoked. The arcade gets it. Wizards got it, like, end of September, end of October. I remember the second I got out of work, me and my buddy, we went right up to the arcade and just... The disappointment was palpable. I remember everybody in there was just, you know, like sort of looking at each other like, what the hell is this?
It felt so unfinished. Like, it's like, can we just ship this back? You guys just, if you can work on it for a few more months, we'll wait. We'll wait patiently. But please fix this.
I remember somebody picked Balrog, did his big punch super. And just went right through the other person without even, like, connecting. And at that point, everyone's just looking at it like, what the hell?
Hitboxes were a suggestion in that game.
And it's fun. This is a game that definitely needed more time to cook. Like, if it had another month or two, I think it would have been fine. I don't know why they got it out when they did. They might have been a contractual thing. because they did Neo Geo Battle Coliseum in, I think, 2005. And that's an Atomos Wave game.
Right.
And that uses the same sort of mechanics. They just add in, like, a tag function. And it is night and day. It is such a better game. It has, you know, the weird guard cancel front step that lets you, like, dash through attacks. It's got the same sort of mechanics around rolling and grabbing. And it works. It just works so much better in that game.
I mean, I don't want to slander any company here, but I do feel like in better times, in better circumstances, if SNK had more resources available, you would hope that, yeah, A, SVCKS could have had a little more time put into it, but also, you know, as was always, as the case with so many series, a sequel would have improved on things. You know, I would argue Capcom SNK, the very first Capcom SNK game, like, that Capcom made, is fine, but I remember being fairly disappointed by that one too when it first came out. But then, you know, then they had the iterative, like, oh, we added two more characters. Like, okay, I'm not buying that for two characters. Then they made Capcom SNK 2, which is like, oh, this is what I want. This is what me and my friends are going to play for hours on end. So it's like, either, yeah, an SVC Chaos that either had more time or had some sort of iterative, if not a sequel, you know, I don't know, a super SVC Chaos or SVC Chaos Special, you know, as was the trend of that era. It could be salvaged, because I would say, unlike, say, Capcom Fighting Jam or the, you know, Evolution, whatever you call it, at least they put in the work to have, you have these, you have backgrounds that are original. They don't really mean anything to anyone, unless you, like, I guess read the tie-in manga, but, like, they have original backgrounds. You know, you've got the entire Capcom roster. These are all original sprites. They're all original sprites. The SNK roster is mostly, you know, is mostly just reused sprites, but some of them, I think some of them are original. I think Mars People is probably original, right? Like, Mars People?
Yeah.
Yep.
I do want to throw out, like, that Dimitri sprite is one of the best sprites I had seen in a fighting game. That is, like, the animation, just the overall look, one of the sickest things I've seen in a game, and I wish that would come back in some way.
That's the thing. Like, playing SVC Chaos, it did not sort of disgust me in the way that Capcom Fighting Jam did, where it's like, oh, this feels like I'm just being sold a collection of leftovers. You know what I mean? Like, you can tell that they obviously put some work into SVC Chaos. They probably just needed more work or more time, or, like I said, an iterative, you know, pass on this thing. But what's there remains to me as an interesting creation, an interesting time capsule. But yeah, as a video game, that as something I'd like to enjoy playing, I can't say that I enjoy playing it. No.
Yeah.
It for me.
And if we're talking about, you know, sunk costs, oh my god, you know, SVC Chaos, I bought that for my Neo Geo, so...
Oh no.
That's an expense. That's a spicy meatball, as we say in New York.
Like, for me, SVC Chaos is kind of fun in short bursts. Like, I was streaming a bunch of not great fighting games a while ago, and I played SVC for quite a while. Like, I didn't quite beat the bosses, because those are very SNK style bosses.
Oh my god.
But I also remember when I played Fighting Jam, I barely did two stages. And I was like, I gotta turn this off. Like, I'm just not having fun. But something else I'd like to bring up with SVC is something that you kind of see, especially in, like, Mortal Kombat games nowadays. I think that was one of the first where every character had an interaction at the beginning of the fight. Like, there was lines of dialogue, and a lot of them were really cool or witty and just kind of cool seeing characters interacting with each other. That's the first time I remember seeing that, where, like, everybody did it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they put in this sort of dedicated, it's all text. It's all text with some, you know, some character portraits that are, you know, like, they cycle through some portraits. So, like, it's not really animated, but they do have some, like, reaction phases. So I think from a budget wise, it's probably not that much intense work. You know, it's just a matter of writing the script and then throwing on some faces to, you know, illustrate what the character is emoting. But yeah, another example of how they definitely had ideas, and they wanted them, you know, they wanted these characters to, you know, be characters. They wanted to uphold all these relationships and make new relationships and make, you know, jokes. Because obviously you've got SNK making a game with Dan in it. Like, that should be hilarious. Like, that alone is kind of funny. It's still funny to me 20 years later, but it would have been a lot funnier if they had the time to actually make, you know, KOF style, like, animations. But, you know, no, they don't have time for that. But they do have time for all this dialogue. And I think I don't know which one it is, but I'm sure there are image generators out there now where you can just make your own versions that are just, you know, type in whatever you want. Insert your memes. Go ahead.
Pretty sure.
Meme them up, kids.
Yeah, so, you know, Capcom completely, you know, dropped the ball. The next crossover game dropped the ball. So, you know, from a competitive standpoint, this is when everybody looked back to Third Strike and said, well, it wasn't great, but maybe we should give it another shot. And that was really, like, in 2004, I'd say. You know, Evo got established out of the B series of tournaments in 2002. And that was sort of like the U.S. national major at the time. And they had, I think it was a Third Strike Invitational or something like that, because Third Strike was not big enough to hold its own tournament. I think it was there in 02. They dropped it in 03. And this was sort of their make good in 04. And that was the one that had the moment where Justin Wong got parried, his full super got parried, and when he was trying to chip out Daigo, and he ate it, as they say, and he's still getting trolled for it 20 years later.
Oh my god, I some of the things people send him on Twitter are just hilarious.
So, you know, this is when Third Strike came back, and I am a noted disliker of Third Strike, but I respect that it managed to get people together enough to come back and become probably the most popular of this era of games. Like, you know, people like CVS2, Arugal can attest, we play it locally pretty often. I know Marvel 2 has its fans in a few areas, but Third Strike, that's the big one.
I think so. One of the things that the Third Strike community does have, which I believe every older retro gaming community should admire, is that they are connected. They have their own community sources. They have their own funding, in a sense, Jazzy Circuit. They have their own funding. They have their own mechanisms for these tournaments, ranking points, and so forth. And you know, they don't mind getting overseas players who have no problem coming, or getting sponsored to come, or someone saying, hey, let's pay for so-and-so to come up here and let's play them and so forth. Other communities currently, like Marvel, they have something similar. They don't have like the same community mechanisms where they have like their own like ranking system and things like that. They just go out and play or go to a session and things like that. That's the same for the CBS2 community, but Third Strike community should be admired, because Japan, Europe, I mean, Brazil, I mean, everywhere, still all the Third Strike players, they still play it, and they play it a lot. They're online, you know, Fightcade is really good. Even the ports for, was that the PS4 port with the championship, with ST and the Third Strike, those are really good. Like, I mean, their ports are really good.
Yeah, I do respect Third Strike's crew. I do wish that Capcom paid that kind of attention to their Naomi fighting games. Because I do think part of what works for Third Strike is that they do get modern home ports.
Right.
In fact, if I remember, one of the things that really helped it around 04, around Evo, is that Capcom put out their anniversary collection that had Third Strike and Hyper Street Fighter 2, which is like their weird mashup version of all the Street Fighters that they put out in arcades around this time, because it was cheap.
If I recall that the PS2 and Xbox ports, those were at that time the closest to like being arcade perfect. Like, I remember hearing the Dreamcast, like people were a little iffy on it, because like
the speed wasn't consistent for each stage. So you could play on like Dudley's stage. You try to do low forward super with Ken and it would come out normal, whereas you go to another stage and it just wouldn't. So a lot of people was like, okay, well, let's just play. That's when everyone went to PS2 for CBS2 and Third Strike and ST. Even though Dreamcast probably had a better ST port, but everyone was like, well, hey, which lets us use the PS2 for everything. Only thing you couldn't use PS2 for was for Marvel 2. That port was absolutely cannot be used at all.
It was awful.
Yeah.
Just, I remember folks getting so amped up when they announced it was coming to PS2 and Xbox, and Xbox was okay, but PS2 just, ugh.
I remember it looked weird too. Like it had like a weird, I don't know if it had like some kind of filter or something over it. Just, it didn't look right. It looked
very pixelated.
Yeah. Like almost like it was just blown up.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like this era, you know, in lieu of getting new good games that were, you know, that would last, we were getting a lot of home ports, home compilations, sort of remastered collections of like older games that people, they just, you know, these companies figured, oh, let's just get these games together and put them out. Because I'm also thinking about the, what was it, the Vampire Collection or the Vampire Chronicle, yep, for matching service. Like that was, I think it was originally a Dreamcast game. And that was kind of like, here's all the Vampire Savior characters we have. Even the ones that we cut from some versions are all here. And you can even choose like which era you want. Like, so they had like, you know, like you could play Dimitri as he was in Darksuckers. You could play Dimitri as he was in Vampire Saver. And even the characters didn't exist in Darksuckers. They had like retro, they had like new retro versions you could play as. It's like really interesting, I think, for, you know, for me as a fan, I was like, oh, I could really, really dig in with all these characters. But yeah, you know, obviously, I mean, does it satisfy in the way that a new Darksuckers game does? Obviously, of course not. But it was an exciting thing for me to see that. But I think a lot of companies were sort of doing that. Like, here's old stuff for you. It's like, okay, but that's where's the new stuff coming from? And it just wasn't. And as you said, some of these ports weren't that great either, or they were just very strange. You know, like a couple of years, you know, once the PSP hits, a lot of Capcom ports are like, oh, let's port this fighting game to the PSP. Let's port this fighting the PSP. And it's like, some of these ports I think are good or interesting, and they try different things, but also like, it's on a PSP. You can only play it so well on a PSP, which is like not the, you know, still not for fighting games. And that's not a great experience. You know, working your listeners. I've got video here. I'm working my thumbs. It's like, it's not, it's hard. It's hard to do, you know, a complex super move on a PSP.
I'd say the only time I had a good time with one of those sort of things was the portable Ultimate Mortal Kombat 3 conversion to the DS. My buddy and I, we actually were able to play that. We had like money matches and whatnot on there because it's Mortal Kombat inputs. So it's nothing super complicated. You just have to put in your lefts and your rights and all that in a speedy enough manner. And the DS D-pad was good enough for that. So, you know, that one was pretty good. I don't know about these PSP ones. I think Capcom was just looking for ways to make more money off of their fighting game materials without having to spend a lot of money. So, like, the PSP versions of Street Fighter Alpha 3, I know they added in some sprites from CVS2 and Capcom Fighting Jam. Like, they threw Ingrid in there because they had the sprite. Why not?
I still have no idea how that Alpha 3 never made it to console. I would love Alpha 3 with Maki in it. I would buy that in a heartbeat.
Was that the one that had Eagle 1 and 2? They had, yep, Eagle 1. Yeah. Everyone wanted that one. It was like, hey, man, you guys can't play that. Sorry.
You want to play this? Well, you will go wanting.
It's like, I'd love, like, this is a really cool idea. You going to bring this to console anytime, please?
Nope.
Okay, cool.
With arcades closing, you know, the competitive events that were still going on, because there were a lot of regionals. I know there was Final Round down in Georgia, Midwest Championships in Chicago, the East Coast Championships. That was that Philly? I don't remember. NorCal Regionals, Texas Showdown. A lot of these were moving over to console just because, you know, that was a lot more cost effective, a lot easier to get materials together for. This is also the time period that Super Battle Opera sort of came up in Japan from like 2003. That was the Japanese national major. They had like qualifying tournaments throughout the country, and then they would have a final tournament bracket, and that was the Super Battle Opera. That was put together, if I remember, by the folks who did Arcadia Magazine, which is an interesting combination. And they would allocate spots for European and American players to come through and, you know, get their faces kicked in these Japanese fighting games. I remember we'd send over our Guilty Gear players, and inevitably, because, you know, the U.S. Guilty Gear scene was very, very sad at the time, they would try, and they would not do too hot, but God bless them.
Yeah, SBO, and especially getting a hold of the footage of SBO used to be super hard, unless you had somebody that you knew that could send you, you know, so you could actually see some of the matches and understand, like, what's going on and stuff. But we had one representative, he used to live here before he moved, Fetz, that was one of my training partners for Tekken and Soul Calibur. He got second or third SBO for Soul Calibur 2. That was the best placing for a United States player there before, you know, they allowed more people to come. So he would bring back some of the, like, because they were still VHS and they weren't online yet, or they weren't put online yet. So we would watch like some of that stuff, like, man, this is what they're doing. Like, this is high tech stuff right here. Like, all right, we got to understand what's going on. And that was a great time, which we could take it back to arcades. It's hard to me, and I'm saying this as an older player who was in Tips and Tricks and stuff like that. It's hard to really get as good as you probably could get, or be on the same level as overseas players. It's very hard right now. We don't have the same community. I mean, even overseas players now, even though they don't go to the arcade as much, they still all get together. They still do house sessions, like big ones. Mm-hmm. Like the Street Fighter VI players, we know that they get together a lot. That's not happening here, of course.
Yeah, and at that time, house sessions were sort of the fill-in for arcades in the U.S. Those were sort of they were something you kind of just had to know somebody to get into, because, again, it's somebody's house. They usually, not always, but usually didn't want random folks just popping in. So you had to go on one of the forums that were around there, like shoryuken.com. There was Dustloop for the Guilty Gear folks. Tekken Zaibatsu, I'm not even sure if they're still around, but that was the big Namco Fighters website.
Yeah, Zaibatsu, that I used to be on there. I was a Tekken player first before I became a Street Fighter player. Mm-hmm. And Zaibatsu, you had to be, you pay for a membership, but with that membership, you would see all the Korean and Japanese videos of, like, you know, their matches or like their tournaments and things like that. And I mean, it was a wealth of knowledge. They had all types of tutorials that they would make up, that the Japanese or the Koreans would make up to show other people, or to show them, you know, their communities, the wave dash techniques and all kinds of stuff like that. And it was great.
Yeah, it was really hard to find footage back then. You had the subscriptions. This was all pre-YouTube, mind. So you at best, you were getting like little tiny real player windows with very low bitrate that you had to download, and or you had to buy VHS or DVDs off of somebody. Even Evo, you know, the first ones, you had you had to buy those tapes.
Had a resolution of like 220 by like 110 or something.
Oh man. I know there was a guy in the Detroit area. Actually, he was from Flint, and he recorded all of our stuff. And I really wonder if he still got those tapes, because I would love to see those online again. There's only like bits and pieces on there, and it's like, wow, we used to be hot in these games. What happened? I want to watch that again. It was a time, and like you couldn't really count on Netplay, because this was all before, you know, GGPO and way before Fightcade. So if you were going to play online, you had Xbox Live, which was not for every game. And it was not a great experience, I can tell you, as someone who played these things online. You had Kylera, which was like, how would you even describe that? It was like peer-to-peer sort of online play for some different emulators. It was also pretty bad. Eventually PSN came along in like 06. That was pretty rough too. These were just bad experiences. You didn't really want to play fighting games online at this time if you could help it, which might be why I still have an aversion to playing fighting games online now, even though they're good in most cases.
I remember I used to anytime an SNK fighter came out on console, I was always there, like picking it up day one. I remember I would buy the PS because the PS2 copy always came out first.
Mm-hmm.
I would buy that while waiting for the Xbox one to come out, sell my PS2 copy and get the Xbox one because the Xbox had online play. And yeah, those were rough. But yeah, to be fair, we didn't really, you know, that was still kind of a new thing. We didn't really know. It's just like, okay, this match is kind of janky. Maybe the next one will be better. Maybe the next one will be better. And I think my final tipping point was Guilty Gear XX Reloaded. That was bad.
Yep, the Xbox port.
I think that's what kind of got me to like, you know, I don't think I'm going to bother with the online play anymore. I'll just get some friends over. And didn't really bother until the eventual Street Fighter 4.
Well, you know, good news. Thanks to the good folks at Insignia, they got the Xbox Live port of Capcom Fighting Jam back online. So that is now the one and only way you can play that online. So, you know, dig out your Xboxes, get in on the game of 2004. Dig into some of the games that were coming out in this time frame, because again, just because Capcom had, you know, basically walked out to buy a pack of smokes and never came back, and SNK was just struggling there. There was still a lot of stuff coming along. Like SNK kept publishing games. Like I said, they had these KOFs, they had Sam Show. So a lot of these were being outsourced to other developers because SNK Playmore was still sort of staffing up and rebuilding their internal development squads. So, like, I remember Samurai Showdown 5 and 5 Special, the aforementioned last Neo Geo game. Those were shipped out to Yuki Enterprise, which they went on to make the Arcana Heart fighting game series later in the aughts. And, you know, Samurai Showdown 5, that was pretty popular at Wizards. 5 Special, I never saw it in arcade until I went to Japan and they had some set up, but like those were pretty good. And 5 Special is probably one of the best fighting games of this period. Then they went on to make Sam Show 6, which I think, you know, Ted Bob's the the big fan
one of the only ones who liked it. Like it's fun because it's almost like it's just the big mashup celebration of Sam Show. You've got like all the grooves for it are based on 1 through 5. And then it's got like, it's kind of this other groove that I guess you can call it the 6th groove, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got like every character. Actually I'm trying to, was there one character excluded or am I misremembering? I want to say everyone was there.
I think everyone was on the console port and the Atomos Wave arcade version was missing a couple.
Yeah. There was, I think one or two characters that kind of got changed up. I think Wan Fu, they changed him up a little bit.
Yes. He lost his stone pillar from 2 when they gave him like a sword or something. I forget.
I think. And yeah, that was the game that introduced your favorite character, Iroha. And by your favorite, I mean the one I love using to fight against you.
They gave her a weapon flip move that she could use unarmed. That was a grab, and it did more damage than her armed weapon flip. So, like, you could disarm her, and it didn't matter, because she could still completely demolish you. And, yeah, it was a game. It was a choice.
This is also the first fighting game where you can play as Andrew Jackson.
Old Hickory?
Yeah, they had young Andrew Jackson as a character. He had a bayonet on a rifle.
He did have weapon. He did have one of the best theme songs in the game.
Yeah, it was like a weird mashup of what was that song? It's like an old American standard. It was very strange.
Oh yeah, shoot, I can't remember the name.
He was a very strange character, but yeah, like Sam Show 5, I was really into. Sam Show 5 Special, I love it. Still pretty popular, especially in this area. The Northern Virginia in particular, they love that game. Every time those folks go out to a tournament that has it, they clean up.
I will say, just about everyone, like everyone I've talked to who's into fighters, who's somewhat familiar with SNK, if you bring up like what SNK fighters you like, 9 times out of 10, they're going to say Sam Show Special.
Yep.
It just hits everything just right.
And there was like some good KOF games in this period. 2002, like in the US, I think it's got a reputation for being kind of a hot mess, but it's still really big in Central America. Like the Mexican players are huge on O2. Even now, I remember seeing some folks from the New York scene recently talking about how, you know, oh, we do these SNK events, and like the Mexican players don't come. They just stick around their own arcade and keep playing KOF 2002. It's just it's one of their dream match games. So it's got a big cast of characters. It's 3v3, like, which is not necessarily the standard for KOF in this time frame. Like 2001. Had 4v4 teams, and you could pick however many you wanted to have as assist calls, which I love 2001. I think
I still hear that
Ted
music.
Bob will back me up on this.
I still hear that character select music to this day.
But I wholly recognize it is a hot mess. Just a trash fire of a game, and it just happened to turn out to be a lot of fun.
Someone at SNK said, hey, Heidern's really good. What if he didn't have to charge?
Yeah. Heidern was all motion moves in this game, but his frame data was still for a charge character. So he was busted, but still not the best character in that game. That was the kind of game 2001 was. They came out with O3, which we touched on a little bit earlier. That one introduced like a tag mode.
Yeah, that was a big change for them. And it's kind of amazing that they actually got that working on the old SNK, the old Neo Geo hardware. The fact that you could actually have all these characters in there and you could swap them out on the fly. It was very impressive at the time, but I don't think it has, certainly not, does not, all these years later, you know, O2 seems to be the one that everyone still plays today and has been ported many times over. And O3, I'm sure there's O3 fans out there, but I don't feel like it's had much, you know, impact overall. But it was impressive at the time.
I'm an O3 fan, I won't lie.
Well, you know, they came out with 11, which that was an Thomas Wave game, and it does basically the tag stuff from 03, but it does it better. So it's one of those cases where, like, well, why would you go back and play the rough draft when you could play the fine-tuned copy? It's like if they had SVC Chaos Special. That's KOF 11, basically.
From KOF 2003 to 11... for me, kind of feels like King of Fighters 12 to 13. It's like 2003 was the unfinished version. And like 11 is the one that's like, okay, we kind of nailed this down. Gato is still going to wreck everything, but maybe not as bad.
Here's Eiji. He's going to be stupid too.
My heart grew when I saw him in that game.
Oh, man.
Not since 95.
And then there was the Maximum Impact games, which I guess were arcade games, but I mostly remember them because they pushed them hard as console releases in the US. And they're extremely weird. These are like 3D KOF fighters.
Yeah. Actually, I think it's something we should probably mention because part of the problem, really, as a whole, part of the problem with sort of the fighting game, doldrums, so to speak, is this is fallout from the sort of 90s attitude that 2D graphics were old and bad. Like, we don't need these anymore. This is what we used in the past, and we should leave it behind because everyone wants 3D graphics now. And I feel like, so part of that was like the bread and, Capcom and SNK were both, their main games were these 2D fighting games, and in some of these cases, beautiful 2D fighting games. You know, obviously, Fighting Jam, not beautiful, but Third Strike. I think Third Strike is, it's going to turn 25 next year. Third Strike is gorgeous. It's a beautiful looking game. But in the, late 20th century, early 21st century, everyone was like, no, pixel art is old, 2D art is old. We need 3D. So there was a real push to make 3D versions of stuff that was normally 2D. And yeah, the KOF Maximum Impact games were kind of like, okay, well, we'll try doing KOF in 3D. And it is. It's very strange. Like, you have some familiar faces, you have some new faces, but it's been a while since I actually played them, of course. I still have my copies, they're over there. But as I recall, you could just hold down shoulder buttons and sort of like dodge to the side as much as you wanted. So like fireballs were basically irrelevant. You just dodge around them. Some of the models were interesting. You could tell they were definitely, they wanted some of the Soul Calibur crowd. So like all the women are like incredibly busty and unzipped. There are definitely fans out there. I know not that long ago at TGS, I saw some cosplayers who were like Maximum Impact characters. Like, hey, I see you, buddy. I see you.
Maximum Impact is I was actually replaying that again recently. That one, it's fun, actually. Like, it's busted as all heck, but it's like one of those where you kind of throw it on, have it a good time. I want to say that, if I'm not mistaken, that was made from some of the developers that worked on Rage of the Dragons and Matra Melee, which is probably
Noise Factory.
Probably explains like their kind of crazy loose combo system that the game's got. Where it just feels like combos just go on forever. but like there are a lot of interesting choices in it. The music's really good. Let me just throw that out there. But like they also, I could be mistaken, but I think this is like one of the artist Falcon, like one of his first like major entries in fighting games. Cause they did a redesign of every character in that game. And some of them are like pretty wild. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I wish that modern fighting games went as wild with some of the costumes that this game does, because you have your alternate version of everyone's outfit, but also you have a million different color options, and some of them also dramatically change the outfits for characters. They went nuts.
There's a lot of weird ones.
Yeah.
Like, Mai has one that I think a lot of fans are either love it or hate it. I'm not gonna lie, I'm a fan of short hair Mai. Yuri, one of her alternates, like they basically turn her into Eri from Metal Slug, which is even funny because Fio from Metal Slug is a playable character in that game, as well as like they threw in like a Hanzo from Sam Show. Eventually they would get like Mizoguchi from that like Fighters
from Karnov's Revenge.
Yeah. From that Karnov fighting game, Fighters Dynamite or whatever it's called.
Yeah. Fighters History Dynamite.
But like it, for as crazy as that game is, like, I kind of wish I'd see more of that today. I'm sure it's a heck of a process and they'll probably charge you $5 or $10 per costume now, but like, it's just like one of those neat little extras that like they didn't have to do it, but they went full ham on it and they did it. And I respect them for that, except for that Rock Howard and Blue Mary. Those were weird.
Just another Rock Howard appearance where he kind of sucked.
Yeah, he wasn't
great. I had to look it up real quick. But Falcon started creeping into the late KOF games. Like he was doing a lot of like cover work. like cover art because after Shinkaro left, so he was doing apparently he did the main illustration for SFC Chaos, like the main poster kind of thing. Hmm. But yeah, for Maximum Impact, he was officially a character designer. So he was like, he wasn't just illustrating; he was like designing these characters like top to bottom. Like here's what they're gonna look like. So
that's cool.
He was very involved in those games.
Very imaginative, I can tell you that.
So, question, do you guys feel that in terms of the new fighters, how do you guys feel with the Unreal Engine?
It's clearly not made for fighting games, but it can work for it.
Because I feel like, so going back, I mean, even with the games you just now mentioned, most of the great games, and I say great meaning like great from our era or like things that we like to play.
Yeah.
They were pretty busted in some way, shape, or form. Somebody had something that was, okay, that's a little too much, but we're going to deal with it because this game's cool. Whereas Unreal Engine, unintentionally, there's stuff that happens. You know, hitboxes are really not hitboxes, of course, but they try to be as much as they could. But there's a lot of balance, you know, and I mean, I can't say that balance is bad, but it's not good. If that makes sense. Like, Third Strike is inherently broken. Everybody knows that. It's amazing how some people still play it knowing that it's broke. But people have learned, you know, over the years and they get around stuff. And now it's, you know, new tech and everything else. Same thing for Marvel 2. Marvel 2 was, you know, 4 characters. Well, you can add 2 more now because now these other 2 guys are extremely good. And if you get touched once, you're going to die now. So whereas now with, you know, I'm just throwing out like Street Fighter 6, you know, it's probably like good 10 characters that are extremely good. Right. And you got like a couple, you know, so-so characters that you could compete with depending on if the person you're playing against sucks, if they don't know. So I think like, you know, going back, just remembering like Unreal Engine, you know, that's what's being used now for, you know, Capcom, Tekken, you know, so forth. But back then it was just, the heyday of, you know, SNK and Capcom, Naomi, Nesca, you know, all that stuff. And those games, they're still fun to this day. The fun isn't there anymore.
Well, you know, you mentioned you were a Tekken player, so like, yes. I know this is the time period where Tekken 5 got came out. Like Tekken 4 mm-hmm. was 2001. It kind of,
yeah,
nobody liked it.
2001.
So I will say it seems like people are kind of turning around on Tekken 4. I've noticed a lot of people like I remember
Tekken 4 wasn't bad. Tekken 4 would so I came up. I started Tekken Tag 1 late, and just all intents and purposes, Tekken Tag 1 is the best Tekken ever. I don't think that's a debate because everyone was broke, but also the system allowed you to just, everybody had something and the system allowed you to just make various comebacks. It was just good. So Tekken 4 came out. The problem was that you could only fight in the arena. You couldn't play on other stages or whatever because everyone had infinites and every character just had, you know, just stuff. The arena was good. If you got caught in an infinite on the arena, like say if you're fighting against Lee and you get wall push, you didn't break the wall push and you did 4-4-4, you're dead. You know, you're going to go all the way around the arena. So Tekken 4, it was okay. It made poking more involved in Tekken. Whereas, you know, Tekken Tag 1, it was more so slight hits till you can get your next character in because they were powered up. And also it was at 120%. Now the newer Tekkens are all are at 100%. I think that's a big thing, that no one talks about. Tekken Tag, you had the ability to make a mistake and still win. Tekken 5 came out. That was the first game that allowed, controllers. So that helped Namco because for a while Namco wasn't doing as well. Soul Calibur 1, arcade release was eh. Soul Calibur 2 arcade release was cool. And then, you know, Soul Calibur 3 was not good. It just wasn't. It was very bad.
Yeah, I remember Soul Calibur 3 Arcade came out like a year or so later after the PS2 version, because I know Pinball Pete's got it in Ann Arbor, and I remember the Soul Calibur players liked it, and everyone else was just like, I don't know, man. Soul Calibur 3 was pretty bad on PS2. I don't know if I want to spend time on this, but...
That's when the Zazamel backturn shenanigans came out, and if you guys remember, they came out with Tekken 5.1 because of like some of the infinite. So they did the same thing for Soul Calibur 3.1, and it wasn't good. It gave it like the balance update or whatever. It just wasn't good, and it just wasn't good.
And this was also sort of like the last gasp of Sega's fighting games. Because this is the era where we got Virtua Fighter 4 and 5, and there was, like, different revisions of both of those. I know VF4, at least, was, like, it got a push here in the U.S. I remember the commercials for it.
It had a pretty brief jump in popularity for a little bit. I remember, like, VF4, I remember playing a lot of, and then they released Evolution, which I think it had some balance changes, and I think it threw in another, like, an extra character, I think.
I don't remember.
I could be misremembering, but something that I remember kind of bugged me was because in the original VF4, they had a classic mode where all the characters were in, like, the original, like, low-poly models. Like, everyone looked like VF1 models. But they did not include that in Evolution, which, like, I was really bummed about.
I think VF4, that was the first one. That was the first VF, and that actually, like, was a main game in Evolution. And it was 2006. That was the one where they got the Toyota sponsorships, and that one got, like, $50,000 pop bonus and stuff. So that one, it was a lot of, like, serious VF players from Japan there. And I mean, it was fierce, but that game was mad hard to play.
Yeah, I never got any good at Virtua Fighter 4 or 5 for that matter. Like, I remember trying, and like I just could not wrap my head around it and all the different options for it.
It was better than DOA. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, so, like, as far as casual fighting games went, this was, like, a pretty good time. Like, you had Dead or Alive, you had Mortal Kombat, like, Deadly Alliance and Deception. I know those were popular. People were playing them. They had, you know, weirder stuff like the Bloody Roar, Primal Fury and 4 came out in the early 2000s. And apparently, like, there's a bit of a resurgence around those games nowadays. I was kind of shocked to hear that. It's also like when the Dragon Ball Z Budokai games came along, and the aforementioned Naruto Clash of Ninja, I think, is what they localized it as. The game that took over our friends' house sessions for about a year, because the people who kept coming through just only wanted to play Naruto.
Was Rumblefish. That was early 2000s, right?
Yeah, Rumblefish 1 and 2 came out in this period.
Rumblefish,
I have a question. Are we considering Fist of the North Star a casual game, or
maybe in Japan?
That was serious business in Japan. Those matches, YouTube match. I mean, they were serious.
Yeah, I think that's a good segue, because like this was the time frame when Arxis really sort of came into its own. You know, Arxis, they'd made the first Guilty Gear fighting game. They made Sailor Moon S back in the 90s for the Super Famicom. And then in, was it 2001, I believe, they came out with Guilty Gear X, which was an arcade Guilty Gear game, because the first one was PS1 only. And it was such a huge jump up from the previous one in terms of like complexity and offense and in terms of not being as completely busted as the PS1 game. I remember this was one Wizards very briefly had. They had like one tournament for it, and I remember my buddy Jen got, I think, third place, and she was pissed that they then sold the machine before the next tournament could happen, because she really wanted the run back against her then boyfriend. So in 2002, they came out with Guilty Gear XX, or you know, X2 in the US, and they did like revisions of this every couple of years after this point, like the Guilty Gear Reloaded we mentioned. They also had Slash and Accent Core and Accent Core Plus, and eventually Accent Core Plus R, which is the last revision from, I think, 2012. And folks still play that one. But, like, this is sort of like the birth of the anime fighting game as, like, a genre. You have these games that have a lot of mobility. They have, you know, these really complex, lengthy combo strings. You have a lot of, like, really funky mechanics that are not often, like, explained very well, but are integral to, like, doing well in them. Like in Guilty Gear XX, you had Roman cancels, you had false Roman cancels. You had, like, of all the weird loops, like, the aforementioned Dust Loop, .com is based off of, I think it was Soul Bad Guy who had a loop. Using his dust button.
You could probably do a college course to learn those games.
Yeah, but you know, Arxis had these Guilty Gear games, but that wasn't the only thing they were doing, because they were making, you know, sort of licensed games for other companies on top of that, like Fist of the North Star.
Yeah,
and those have a lot of the same hallmarks.
Yeah, it's funny how you're listing off these qualities, like, oh yeah, okay, weird mechanics don't explain well, you want a long combo? Yes. Long combo. Let's talk about Fist of North Star, where, you know, at a tournament level, if you get trapped in a combo, players start pick up a book and start reading.
I'm gonna go make a sandwich while you do this combo. Yeah. I'll be back.
Oh, there was also Sengoku Basara Cross, which was published by Capcom, but made by Arxis. It was based off of a series of games that Capcom was making, the Sengoku Basara. And that is also extremely weird, because it has assist calls, right? But these assists are on a meter bar. They have levels, and like, depending on their level, it'll change what the assist can do, and that builds up over time. You have infinites, because, of course, it's like Fist of the North Star in that regard. You have the best characters in the game can just pretty much ignore the rules that everybody else has to follow, like Fist of the North Star. Like, it's a very strange game, and I don't know what Arxis was doing there, but they put it out. I'll give it to them on that one. I think, unlike Fist of the North Star, nobody's defending the Sengoku Basara Cross. I don't think anyone barely remembers this, but I tried it out again for the first time in probably 14 years for this recording, and was like, wow, now I remember why I didn't play it very long 14 years ago.
But also, talk about Sign of the Times. Fist of the North Star was a 2005 arcade game, and I know the arcade, like, they made an English version of the arcade ROM. But then when it came time for the home port, they only released it for PS2 in Japan, but it was 2007. Like, 2007 PS2 game only in Japan. So it's like, no, PS3 already out, but no, we're not doing PS3. It's for PS2, and it's only here. So import it or don't play it. Like,
yeah, I remember that sort of played against Arcana Heart, which was another one of those like very anime-style games. Because the second one came out on PS2, and everybody, I remember on Shoryuken, I was looking up like how was the port, because I played the first game when I went to Japan in 2007. I was like, all right, this is pretty cool. I wouldn't mind like checking this out a little further, because it's like, okay, you pick your character and then you pick an Arcana, and that like affects what moves you have. So it's like a really complex sort of groove system, I guess, in that regard, or ism, like from Alpha 3. But then you get into like Arcana Heart 2 on the PS2, which was like missing a tons of frames of animation. It didn't play at like the same speed as the arcade version. So just a lot of people just trashed it and was like, this is basically unplayable. We can't really use this. I think Rumblefish was in that same sort of boat. I remember people complaining about the PS2 port of that. And Rumblefish 2 didn't get a port until, what, like 2 years ago? So that was one that was almost impossible to play unless you could find a cab.
Yeah, they made it playable. They just wanted to... They locked a few characters and charged you for it, but that's another story. Yeah. Arcana Heart was... I think that was the one where I realized a lot of... I don't think you'd really want to call that like a doujin fighter per se, but a lot of doujin fighters kind of take after that in Guilty Gear.
Well, it started as a doujin fighter. Melty Blood, the first one was like from 2002. It was published by like one person on Windows. And then that got ported around to like arcade and PS2, and they got some sequels.
Yeah, like we're talking like games that have like very long combos, like they're very difficult to play casually, because unless you know these long string of combos, you're not doing any damage. Like rounds can just take forever if you're just like kind of playing casually and you don't really have like a feel for everything in the game. You know, you didn't take a 3-part course in learning it.
You get familiar with the time over screen for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Get used to that if you don't know any of the like the strings.
And that was another one. Like there was a home port, didn't come out in the U.S. I don't even think the arcade version came out in the U.S. I know some of these Atomos Wave games that SNK did had Western versions, but the only place I've ever seen any of them is at the Galloping Ghost arcade in Chicago, and that is, you know, in recent memory. And it's run by an arcade collector who goes out of his way to find rare arcade boards. So I don't think that's very indicative of how common they were.
I can certainly tell you Michigan rarely got those machines.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess it's worth noting, this is also when the Smash scene sort of came into its own. Like Smash Brothers Melee came out in 01. And after a few years, it sort of built its own fighting game scene. But because the traditional FGC was just so moribund and you really couldn't get into it unless you really, really wanted to, this sort of developed its own culture and its own scene around it. And eventually they sort of were trying to get what would be the proper term here? They wanted to get acceptance from the broader FGC, and that took a long time.
They wanted their Evo spot and everything.
Yeah, they wanted it in Evo, which they did eventually get. There were some real clashes. Oh, go ahead.
MLG helped them get that.
Oh, that's right.
That Evo spot. Remember MLG was giving those big sponsorship pot bonuses to them, Tekken, and Halo at that time.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah, the Smash Bros. Thing to me was so strange, because for me, I had played the N64 version, and I enjoyed it, and, you know, I had a GameCube, so I took what I could get on GameCube, and I thought that game was really fun, and, you know, I kept playing it, and so, of course, I would look up, you know, information about it on, like, you know, fighting game websites or go to game FAQs and, like, go to the fighting game boards. And there was such hostility at the time. It's like, oh, that's not a fighting game. And, like, what do you mean it's not a fighting game? It's like, what are we doing here? We're literally two characters are fighting on the screen. Get the hell out of here. But there was this sort of, I don't say style at the time, because people are still like this, but, like, there was this real big pushback. Oh, that's for those people. That's not our kind of fighting game. But it's literally a fighting game. It's what we're, you know, let's not you know, why would we refuse such a, you know, even, you know, even that, which Melee was the second installment, like, there's a lot going on in Melee. It's not just, you know, it's not just a button masher, like, this, you know, this science there. And, you know, I'm so grateful that eventually people caught on. And, like, obviously, I'm not a competitive type player of these games, so, like, I'm not trying to get into tournaments or anything, but, like, to me, I was so put off at the time that anyone would sort of reject this as inclusion in the space of fighting games, when it was very clearly a game about fighting other people, even if the rules were different, because, you know, the percentages go up instead of down when you hit people, like, whatever. It's just, come on, it's an interesting, fun game.
It was more so purist. So one of the hard things, and Kevin knows, I used to be a TO pretty much until I retired. So it's hard sometimes, especially when dealing with different communities who don't understand. The Smash community, well, in that time, the Smash community was more like whiny kids. So it made it very hard to really, I can't even say take up for them, because there were some top players, I mean, some of us that were like, yeah, you know, it's okay. You know, I wouldn't say it's a fighting game, but it's a game. You know, they liked it, but they made such an emphasis, you know, to get an Evo spot, and a lot of stuff got muddied, you know, and it was like, okay, all right, just let them get in, because it's getting annoying now. I think Melee is their, that's their super turf. That's their, okay, this is their stalwart. The other ones, it's cool, but I think Melee, in terms of skill, I think that's probably the most skillful Smash game. And I mean, yes, it is a sign of, like, actually watching them play, like, okay, this is pretty good. You know, these guys are working hard. But those are the players, the people who are, you know, trying to get them, into different communities and stuff. They're like, they're not players. So it's kind of hard to respect them. Whereas the players are more like, hey, you know, this is what we do. Sure, we got big personalities, but we're really good players. Cool. Like I said, the communities that try to do, you know, that will wind their way into stuff, and, you know, that kind of stuff, that kind of, like, muddy the waters.
It's Smash is a very interesting one. I mean, first off, that debate over whether or not it's a fighting game, I mean, that would go on for, like, another 20 years. Like, that I think that fight only just recently kind of died down, like, shortly after, maybe a little after Ultimate came out. And, like, I consider it a fighter. Like, there's a lot of technical stuff there. It is a fun game, too. I always enjoyed Smash. I will say, like, kind of playing a few players, like, in that community, like, checking out some of the tournament stuff and with a few. There is almost this weird, like, you've got, I guess you can get this in any community, but I really saw this in the Smash communities. Like, you have a group that's like, almost like, we just want to be accepted in this FGC. Like, we just want to be acknowledged on it. And then there's this other group that's almost like very gatekeeping. Like, you have to sign a document in blood or something in order to get accepted to us. Like, it's kind of weird. But, I mean, hey, like, I've seen a lot of cool stuff done in there. I'm not going to make any friends on this. I love Smash. Like, it's super fun. I think the tournament scene is boring as all heck. For me, it's give me all four players. Give me the chaos. Give me everything. I cannot do that game with no items one-on-one. That's just me personally. So if...
Yeah, I respect what they do. And, you know, the playing Smash, that is a game that will wreck your hands on a competitive level, as well as your controllers. So, like, more power to the folks that are really into it and, like, really work hard to get really good at it. It is not for me on the competitive scene. I am a casual Smash player, and I am happy to just mess around with the chaos and bathe in it. Because, you know, that was a big point of division, because, you know, traditional FGC, you know, you're playing by standard rule sets. If you were doing anything outside of that, like, you know, banning a character, that was for very serious stuff. Like, I remember banning Akuma in Super Turbo. That was a huge debate at the time. And I don't think it really got settled until, for the most part, folks stopped playing Super Turbo. And it was mostly the West Coast and East Coast scenes at that point, and they sort of revived it. But for Smash, you know, it was like, okay, well, we're going to ban this because it doesn't work this way that we want it to in Melee. And it's like, okay, you can't have items on in Melee because they'll randomly explode, and that is not really fun for what you're trying to do. And then they came out with, you know, Smash Brothers sequels, and they were just like, okay, well, this is the rules we had in Melee. We're just going to copy-paste them over here. It's like, well, you could revisit this. You don't necessarily have to use the exact same rule set that you came up with for Melee for these very specific reasons. They're like, oh, no, no, it's what we're going to do. So, never clicked for me in that way. But yeah, I think they've become accepted at this point, in part because Smash players have just joined the broader FGC. Like, a lot of them play, like, Skullgirls now, or they play Street Fighter or Guilty Gear. So there's just a lot of cross-pollination, and I think with that, and, you know, the just general turnover and churn of people playing, that it just sort of happened over time. And if you would consider it part of the FGC, it's by far the biggest part of the FGC, to the point where, like, locally, Smash is, like, 4 of the 5 nights of the week at locals is Smash, and then the other night is everyone else. Just sort of mashed into one little space. So we're past the hour and a half mark, so I guess we can start winding down on, like, how did this Dark Age sort of conclude? And I think it really started turning around in 2008, because, you know, you had the release of Street Fighter 4 and Tekken 6, if I remember, but you also had Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo HD Remix on the Xbox 360 and the PlayStation 3, and this was also not too long after GGPO came along, which was sort of a rollback, a netcode that was getting applied to a lot of older fighting games in emulation. And all of a sudden that meant, oh, hey, I can play all of these, you know, CPS 1 and 2 games early on. And eventually they added in, like, Neo Geo, the Mortal Kombat boards, and a few other things. And HD Remix did not use GGPO, but the netcode it used was basically just like the super value version of GGPO.
I think some of the GGPO guys worked on that too, if I'm not mistaken.
I know they were consulted. I don't remember if they directly worked on it, but they were involved. And that game actually had good netcode, unlike all fighting games before that point, and most of them afterwards. So that got people, like, because it was Street Fighter 2. Everyone knew Street Fighter 2. That was the game in the 90s. And now you could play it with good netcode. It was rebalanced in a way that I think me and Ted Bob liked, and apparently other folks didn't.
It's very divisive. Like, it got a lot of really high review scores, but depending on the communities you talk to, they either love it or hate it. And yeah. I think a lot of the hate really kind of just came from the artwork, which so the art was done by Udon. Omar Dogan did the backgrounds, and I am blanking on the name of the one that worked on whose artwork was like the inspiration for the sprites. They're interesting. They're definitely very chunky, if that makes sense, like, especially compared to the other sprites. Like, Zangief is just this huge mass on the screen. But, like, this would eventually get revised into Street Fighter Ultra on the Switch, which used a lot of that, and I think it fixed a lot of things on it. Plus, it added Violent Ken and Evil Ryu, and new sprites, too, which was kind of cool. But, like, there were a lot of these weird... Well, I should start by saying, like, this game was... delayed like for a long time. And
it was
part
at
of
least
it,
a year overdue, if I remember.
And a lot of it was, this was just a huge task that I don't think Udon was really prepared for. And like, you can kind of see a lot of hiccups in the work. Like there's some sprite. I know Balrog in particular, his duck blocking sprite, the sprite shrinks when he blocks. Like, and there's some other weird stuff like that. Yeah. It just seemed like it was way too ambitious of a task. Like, you know, they're just doing like frame by frame redraws. Like they're not, the animation's not smoother or anything. It is like a 1-to-1 frame redraw. But I also think like kind of the chunkiness of the characters kind of, it's not that the hitbox has changed, but like it kind of feels like they do, because like it's almost like the characters kind of expand beyond the hitbox. So like it's kind of a little more difficult to time things, like from what you're used to in Turbo.
I will say that this game was probably one of the first fighting games that was really designed around a standard control pad. So like they took a lot of the 3-button moves and cut them down to 2 buttons. They made super motions. Like you could still do the old super motion if you wanted to, but they added in like easier motions for some of them. Like I know Guiles became like down back to down forward to up forward, which is a much less complex motion. And that was specifically for pad players.
I appreciate what they did with Geef and T-Hawk,
yep,
where it's a forward, half circle forward to do a, yeah, instead of doing 360s.
They gave them a KOF style command grab motions. Geef was actually pretty good. I think folks were shocked when Snake Eyes came out of nowhere, like this online only player came to Evo playing Geef, who everyone was like, oh, he's Geef and Super Turbo, he kind of sucked, and just like demolished everyone in HD Remix. So, you know, I respect it a lot.
I remember having a lot of fun with that game, but my lasting memory of its aesthetics is the in Chun-Li stage, there is just a giant-eyed anime girl in the background, just kind of standing there, and she looks, you know, she looks completely out of place because, like, you know, like, you know, that stage has a lot of people in the background, but they're all doing something. You know, you got the chicken guy, you got the bicycle guy, everyone's there for something, but for whatever reason, in the new version, that has stuck that anime girl right in front, and she's got these massive eyes, and she's staring basically at the player like through the screen. And it's just, it's cursed, I want to say. It's like haunted. It's
just staring right into your soul.
It's the original Doki Doki Literature Club right there.
Oh, no.
It's just preparing itself for its own creepypasta story.
But yeah, real fun. And yeah, between that and Street Fighter 4 coming out and being successful. And honestly, I feel like once that sort of broke the water, if you will, or broke the dam, if you will, it kind of happened again, what happened in the early 2000s, where it's like, oh, people like fighting games, huh? Well, let's bring back let's port our old fighting games to modern systems. And especially with the rise of digital distribution, you had, we don't have to make a package anymore. We can just put this on the digital storefront. So you had a lot of, like, you know, the Darksuckers came back, and there was Darksuckers, was it Resurrection?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
Although the funny thing with that one is, that was put on store shelves in Japan as a physical product, and it just cost twice as much, but it's the same goddamn game. And I remember going to the store, I was like, God damn it, this should be a budget. You know, this is, you know, it's a port of 2 games from, you know, 15 years ago at this point. Why is this, like, you know, $40? But yeah, it's kind of like the cycle repeated again, but this time, because it's all online, you know, region stuff doesn't really matter anymore. It's so easy to buy games from out of region on these new systems. Suddenly it's a lot more palatable, and it's a lot easier to sort of, you know, work around and just find stuff that sounds interesting. And obviously by this point, YouTube is big. You can watch, you know, trailers, you can watch, you know, combo videos, you can, you know, learn while you're in your own house, just learn how to play these games, practice on your off time. Like, suddenly there's so many more resources available, and accessibility is through the roof. And yeah, as you said, like, actually playing the games online is now feasible. You know, I would say it's probably gotten better overall with new technology, but still, like, it went from forget it to, oh, okay, to where we are now. And
yeah,
Yeah, you could see the growth there. So it's like, if the takeaway from this time is like, it's not that the early 2000s were bad for fighting games, because there were still plenty of interesting games being made, and there's still plenty of ways to enjoy these games, but it took a lot more effort and, you know, a lot more dedication, and it was harder to do this stuff, whereas like right before and right afterwards were kind of these, you know, wonderful, look how much there is, and all of a sudden there wasn't so much, like, oh, well, but I wanted more. Yeah. And it came back, just, you know, like SNK, it died and then it got better.
There were so many, like, good fighting games that came out just, like, right after Street Fighter 4 as well. Like we got the Western sort of pseudo-sequel, the Tatsunoko versus Capcom. That was, like, really cool. You had Mortal Kombat 9 that came out and was, like, really well-received. Like, I think a lot of the MK heads nowadays still look at MK9 and, like, that was really, really good. That was one of the best MK games. I would still play it if anybody would still play it.
Usually between 9 and 10, but I think a lot of people tend to lean a little more towards 10.
Yeah, and like Marvel 3 came out in this like time period. People yeah. still
came out twice.
Like Marvel 3. Yeah, came out twice in like an 11-month period.
It's kind of funny. Like it seemed like you had this period where Capcom wasn't making any fighting games to all of a sudden, you could argue, maybe they're throwing out too many fighting games now. Because after 4, it just like... It's like, okay, can we get caught up on these games before you start throwing these other ones out? Like, I mean,
yeah,
it's funny how a decade off and Capcom fell right back into the old habits of, you know, re-releasing the same game over and over and over again with minor improvements. And it just, you know, eventually they caught on. It's like, oh, we can just make this digital, you know, we can put a product on the shelves, but we also need to make a version for the people who bought the last one to just make the new one. And in some cases they got it right. And in Marvel Capcom 3, they got it fucking wrong, because they literally released a new game in the same calendar year, and it's like, oh, here's the rest of the characters that we made. It's like, but I already bought this game. I bought it in the spring,
barely half a year.
Couldn't you just make it as a patch? And they're like, no.
Oh, we didn't expect it yet. Like when they said it for Street Fighter 4, it's like, oh, we didn't expect Street Fighter 4 to be this popular, so we have to make a new game that we can't add to. It's like, okay, I can sort of see that you didn't expect it to blow up, because it definitely blew up. But then when it happened again for Marvel Capcom 3, you're like, oh, come on. Come on, Capcom. Come on.
And we had, like, the home ports of KOF 13 and Tekken 6 came out, and this was, like, the first KOF game that really caught on in the U.S. Competitively. I think because it was the first game that the folks who run EVO wouldn't gatekeep because they thought it was ugly. And they're like, all right, KOF 13, now it looks like a real game. We'll let them play it on our stage.
Yeah, and then you also had the Ultimate matches, right? You had KOF 98 Ultimate Match and 02. Yep. Like, those are also, like, early, you know, XBLA, PSN, digital-only releases. I mean, maybe there's a physical cart somewhere, but, like...
They did come out on PS2.
Oh, yes. Okay.
In Japan.
I think 98 came out to the States.
Oh, you're right. Yes, 98 UM did come out in the US.
Yeah, 2K2, I don't think, did.
Yeah, And Neo Geo Battle Coliseum came out on XBLA as well from this time period, too. Like, yeah.
But yeah, now 98 and 02 Ultimate Matches, those are on Steam now. You know what I mean? Those are, you know, those are easier to play than the actual original games. At least
yeah, and like,
legally.
They were really good. I remember we put a lot of time into 98 UM.
A lot of time.
Because, yeah, Ted Bob, he used to run house sessions out of his dad's garage, and... We played a lot of 98 UM, a lot of Street Fighter 4, just real good times.
98 UM, I would say easily, to this day, my favorite fighting game of all time. Like, I have sunk way more hours into that than just about any other game.
You sunk enough time into that when we were playing other folks in the region, and, like, one of them picked Omega Rugal just to just to be a troll, you perfected that Omega Rugal with Brian Battler.
Brian Battler, of all characters, who needs to come back in 15.
You were grinding that game.
The only other game I really played as much, I apologize if there's a little bit of a tangent, but we were talking about Marvel 3, and I feel it necessary to bring up, you know, kind of the testing ground for Marvel 3, which was Tatsunoko versus Capcom. Mm-hmm. To this day, I think is heavily underrated, but I also think a lot of it's because it was kind of stuck on the Wii. I feel like, yep, if it could have gotten a port to anything else, it may possibly be a much bigger game than it turned out to be.
Yeah, for sure.
Super fun. It's super fun. It was a regular here in arcades, and I would just, whenever I saw it, I would always pop in a coin, and I would just play Golden Light on and just be, you know, be this massive beast and have fun with it. Basically, right until the last boss, who's also a beast, and just, you know, it's really hard to fight beast on beast, but still,
yeah.
It was always worth it. It was always worth putting that coin in and getting, you know, getting 10, 15 minutes worth of that experience. And it was, yeah, it is a shame that the only legal home version is on a Wii.
I will say one of my proudest moments of this game, it's the first fighting game tournament I ever entered. Ooh. And it's also the first one and only one that I've won.
Oh!
And I did it playing Roll, who I adored in that game.
she had some crap in that game.
They had to make up for Roll in Marvel 2. They had to make up for it, and oh my, did they. I mean, shoot, in the US release, she has a juggernaut glitch where she can get an infinite power buff. I love it.
I forgot about that.
But I mean, it's just so many wonderful characters. It's the first time you'd see another rival school's character. Alex from Third Strike would make a return finally. They acknowledged Mega Man Legends. And on top of that, just like all these crazy Tatsunoko characters from like Duranjo, Yatterman, Gatchaman, like characters that I doubt half the people in the States ever even heard of. Maybe the exception of Gatchaman. And like, you know, there was a Cashern anime that played on Saturday Sci-Fi. Yeah. Outside of that, like I think barely anyone ever even heard of these characters. And
I should maybe explain to listeners who don't know, like the base game is supposed to be a tag team game where you choose two characters and, you know, kind of Marvel Capcom style. But instead, in Tatsunoko, if you pick this one character called Golden Lighton, he is literally a giant gold, like,
it's like a lighter.
Basically looks like a cigarette lighter, but he's got like arms and legs. And he's so big, there's no tag team. It's just him. You just have one character, but it doesn't matter because he's so massive. You will probably win because his attacks cover half the screen. It's like his one punch, you know, it's like, it's kind of like Juggernaut and Marvel superheroes, except like ridiculously huge, like absurdly huge. Makes no sense. That's why I love it. I love it.
Yeah. It's the first game I can think of where like you got these like two giant characters that can go up against these tiny characters, yes. It works out really well because, like, the giant characters aren't even that good. Like, well,
I think eventually PTX got to be pretty good. Like, people found some good tech with him.
Yeah, he was a problem in the U.S. release, but in the Japanese one, like, both of them weren't that great. Yeah, I'm still super bummed when I found out, like, because, like, this was kind of, I don't know what kind of budget they really had on this, but like there were some director notes on stuff that got cut from the game, and a lot of interesting characters unfortunately got cut. It was going to be Phoenix Wright's first entry into a fighting game.
Oh,
the U.S. release was going to have Leon Kennedy from Resident Evil, but they swapped him out for Frank West because Dead Rising was huge at the time. Tyrant was on the list. I think M. Bison. Tatsunoko's side was going to be Samurai Pizza Cats. I think an Evangelion was, I think one of the Avas was going to be playable.
Oh,
and the
God.
One that really broke my heart, JJ from Red Photon Zillion was going to be a playable character.
Yeah. Deep cut from Sega, like crossover right there.
That one hurts.
Oh, so some of the Capcom folks would make it, may show up eventually in Marvel 3, Ultimate Marvel 3. I know Phoenix Wright is there, and
yep.
Frank is there. Yeah, some of them would show up later, but okay.
Zero. This was another game where Zero was overpowered as hell, and that he just kept that going in the Marvel games.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Zero was also in Tatsunoko Capcom, and he was a problem in that, too.
Yeah, for different reasons than he was in Marvel, which is my favorite. He's always a problem, but in different ways in every game.
It's kind of like Sagat and Iori. They're always a problem.
So you had these new games that were coming out, and it was a lot easier to, like, find people to play with. Like, it was online. The forums sort of got revitalized. I remember there was a meme on Shoryuken of 09ers, like, people who came in playing Street Fighter 4 and were looking for tech and for, like, local meetings places. So you started seeing, you know, offline gatherings wherever anyone could cram one in. I know Detroit area, they met up at, like, bars. They met up at a bowling alley in, like, a spare room. When I was a newspaper reporter, I actually did a feature about the local FGC, and I remember the photographer's like, "This is a bowling alley. Are you sure I'm supposed to, like, go here?" And I'm like, "Yes, that is the place." So, and then, you know, eventually Facebook groups took over from forums, but those were still fairly searchable. So it was no longer just house sessions. This sort of also revitalized a lot of regional tournaments. Sort of took off. Some of them became majors in their own right, like national majors. But it was a heck of a time, and it sort of leads directly to where we are now. And I know Rugal alluded it to a little bit, where you have games that are getting patched on, like, a seasonal level at this point. There's sort of more esports. You're getting more big pop bonuses. The developers are really focusing in on competitive play and balancing things for that group. It's a different time, and I'm not sure it would have necessarily happened if you didn't have that, like, near extinction event in the 2000s. It's the Devonian extinction event right there. Does anyone else have anything they want to say before we wrap it up?
I have a kind of an open question. So of, like, the Dark Ages, what is your game of choice? Like, what may not be your, like, your favorite, but, like, something you find really interesting.
I mean, I'm terrible at it, but again, much like Tatsunoko vs. Capcom, whenever I find a Fist of North Star cabinet in the wild, I definitely enjoy playing that one. Even though I cannot do anything in that game, I'll barely last, you know, two matches against CPU. But it's still, like, you know, I love those characters. So it's just a really fun, and it's a really good looking game. You know, it's not on par with, like, Third Strike. It's going more anime style, but still, big characters, you know, big moves, rocking soundtrack, really fun. And also, I don't even know the names of these games, but I just remember, you know, again, I moved here in 2007, so I would find a lot of, like, weird, I guess, doujin games in arcades, and some of those would be really interesting. I think, oh my god, what's the one where you can basically be a tank with a skull for a face?
Oh, shoot.
It's got a German name, right? Like,
yeah.
Akutsat Blitzkampf? I don't remember.
Yeah, something like that. I apologize, listeners. I don't know the name of that game, but that's the kind of game where I would, again, I'd find it, I'd see the tank. Oh, I get to be the tank in this one. And you play, one of the characters is just a tank with a skull face, and that is as awesome as it sounds.
They eventually got added to that Blaze Blue tag game.
Yeah.
Including the tank was one of the playable characters.
All right. I'm going to try to Google this right now while other people talk.
Jason, you want to go next?
I think, so outside of CVS Marvel, I would say Third Strike. I mean, that's the game with the most longevity. ST was good too. I mean, I did have some interest in, the Vampire Saber series, but if you actually wanted to get, like, games and actually want to learn stuff, I would say, Ries for me.
Okay. I'm going to go with a deep cut here. I'm going to go with Power Instinct Matra Melee.
Thank you.
Which is, it's not a great competitive game. It's very busted, like a lot of these games of its time were. It has that, you know, Noise Factory, very like sort of loose combo system, but it is so goofy. I could not get enough of it. My buddy Ken, who posted these house sessions, he had an AES setup, and he'd always get the new Neo Geo fighting games because he was a big fighting game guy. And he got Matra Melee, and we put a lot of time into that game. It was big for us. It's got like a weird cast. Like there's the big dog man Poochie. There's like a monk. There's like a magical girl who can turn you into a duck. A couple old grannies. And the Japanese version on top of that has sampled music and like lyrics and everything. It's a very strange game. You can even like call in the referee and like use him as a weapon. Like you could knock him into your opponent and whatnot, and a shield. Yeah, you could grab him and use him as a defensive measure.
I do have to say, if anyone that plays that game, you need to play the Japanese version so you can get the correct soundtrack. The soundtrack is like half that game. It's kind of hard to say without just saying go listen to it. Like I imported that CD the moment I could, and that has like never left my car stereo.
Yeah, I cannot recommend that soundtrack enough. The Western releases, they have like four or five songs, and they're pretty good. They're very standard like Neo Geo style music.
They're Rage of the Dragon tracks, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know if they're Rage of the Dragon tracks, but they're very much in that same vein. So like Rage of the Dragons had a great soundtrack. It's pretty good. Matra Melee, they have like these are like full vocal tracks, and they are about the weirdest topics imaginable.
Like every genre's in there.
There's a stage that takes place in a computer store, and you have these like three idol style girls in the background singing about overclocking your computer.
I think my favorite is the depressed girl at a diner cursing a waitress for taking her plate of fries away from her.
Yep, before she was done with them. Or the alien song that's just called Our Secret, and it's about how like, oh yeah, we're really friendly, but really we're here to take over. It's fine. It's yeah, I love that game. It's so bonkers.
Hello, I've returned from my Googling. I just want to say that the series has changed names many, many times over the years, but the arcade version that I played was almost certainly called Akatsuki Blitzkampf. But they're still making revisions and new versions of the game, and according to Wikipedia, there was a release in early 2023 called EN Eins Perfect Welt Anastasis, which is all part of the same series. So I don't know if every game... Is the tank still there? I couldn't say. But Akatsuki Blitzkampf is definitely the arcade one that I played with the tank and the skull face. So you can look for that if you want. But also, maybe the new games have good characters. Maybe there's a bomber with a happy face on it. I don't know. Could be anything.
All right, Ted Bob, take us home. What's your pick?
So we were talking about Dojin Fighters earlier, and I'm really not a fan of a lot of them. But there's one in particular that... It probably helped that it's based on an anime I really enjoyed watching. It's called Umi Neko, When the Seagulls Cry. And they had a fighting game in, I think it was 2008, that eventually got a Steam release. It's like, I believe it's Umi Neko Golden Fantasia, if I'm not mistaken.
Something like that.
It's a really fun tag game. Like all the music is from Umi Neko is like a old visual novel, but like almost like this kind of murder mystery esque. But it's kind of a weird choice for a fighting game, but I appreciate that they did it. It's really fun, and it's one that I actually feel is a little bit more casual friendly. Like you've got crazy combos and weird stuff like that, but like you do damage. So
you
it's
do
like
do you, damage.
You don't need to like know like these, you know, 200-400 hit combos just to do like a quarter health. Like you can have like some pretty fun casual sessions, and there's a lot of wackiness to it that I really enjoy. I could probably gush about that game for a while, but I know we're nearing the end here.
All right. Well, I think that's a good point to call it. So this has been a Retronauts podcast. It should be available in most of your favorite podcatchers. This is a listener-supported podcast through Patreon. You can find us at www.patreon.com/retronauts. For just $3 a month, you get early access to every Monday episode ad-free and at a higher bitrate. And if you bump that up to $5, you get a pair of additional Friday episodes each month, and you get access to the Discord server and Diamond Fights This Week in Retro columns, and their This Week in Retro, or This Month in Retro community podcasts. Yes. Blanking out there.
It's
a very good deal.
Thank you. And certainly, I must say, I've done a lot of fighting game coverage in the weekly columns because I like to celebrate those anniversaries because I feel like, you know, sometimes these games get overlooked, even though I know they're popular. There's lots of fighting game fans, but I feel like, you know, it gets lost in the shuffle of the Metal Gears and the Half-Lives. Like, you know, these fighting games are also good, and some of them are really weird. You know, like, I'm a person who likes World Heroes 2. I'll write about World Heroes a lot because I like World Heroes.
Thank you.
Heck yeah. So, Diamond, do you want to, you know, where can folks find you?
Well, you can find me physically in Osaka, but don't do that. You don't want to do that. I'm a big eater. But still, you can find me online by looking up Fight Club. See, it's a little joke. It's a little joke. You get it? My last name, it's F-E-I-T, and then C-L-U-B. That's a word you already know.
There you go. Ted Bob, how about you?
So I'm on, I mainly focus on Twitter as TedBob84, but I am on other platforms from YouTube to Twitch. I sometimes do art streams, the occasional game stream, although I probably haven't done one of those in many months now. But I generally do a lot of artwork and animations that I post up there.
All right. And Rugal.
So I am on, well, X, of course. It's not Twitter anymore. It's X, at Rugal Fury, and same thing on Discord at Rugal Fury, with the random numbers, of course, they give you.
All right. And as for me, you can find me on Blue Sky and Twitter/X under Ubersaurus. I'm on YouTube under Atari Archive, which is my video series looking at the history of the Atari video game 2600 platform, game by game. That is Patreon supported under the same name, Atari Archive. I have a commensurate book, Atari Archive Volume 1, currently on sale through Amazon and the Limited Run Games web store. And of course, if you are a fighting game player in the DC region, I do show up to locals regularly, and I'm happy to run some of these Dark Age fighters, you know, at any point. So, thank you all very much for listening. Have a good rest of your night.
Good night.